From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents A Conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for July the 23rd, 2017. Welcome once again to our weekly look at the politics and policies that shape your lives, going from Chicago and Springfield all the way to Washington, D.C. Yep, time to grab the Sunday paper, go get that cup of coffee, and we'll try to get everything this week off to a good and informative start. Well, I'll tell you, it's a muggy one out there. I was just out on the Storm Center patio, a very muggy Sunday morning, but it's still bright, shiny. It's what you should expect for this time of year, you know? It just, and I noticed, thank you, Dave, for telling me about the Big Ten race or whatever it is that's going on. Because
Big 10K.
The Big 10K, because I noticed all these people, runners with numbers, but they all had like shirts with the various Big Ten teams on them.
Oh.
So I figured there had to be something
that explains Big Ten, then,
yes,
doesn't it?
Yes,
not 10K necessarily, although it could be a 10K race, but Big Ten sports, the Big Ten schools.
Yes, but I didn't see anybody with Illini wear.
Oh, we have to fix that.
Yeah, I saw Michigan and Ohio State. Didn't see any Illini.
Yeah.
Or Northwestern.
Keep in mind also, as I pointed out in the traffic report, that in addition to this going on this weekend now, the beginnings of the setup for Lollapalooza is underway. They started moving things in Thursday and into Friday.
Swanee, can you start sending me updates? Because I take a new route every Sunday, and I just keep getting orange cones and block off. I swear.
They know you're coming.
Route. Sam. Today I took a different route, still got blocked.
I'll be happy to help, Sam.
Please.
I'll be happy to help. You bet.
Well,
Rick,
I'm...
how about you? You want text as well?
You're just sitting here in the newsroom. I know you're not doing anything earlier. Just let us know and help a brother out.
That could be a new app, the Dave Traffic app, right?
Helpabrotherout.com.
Well, I knew that the Lala stuff had to be, you know, was going to be starting pretty soon. I didn't realize it was already, you know, related to, I suppose, since they have Balboa already shut down or whatever, that they might as well just leave it down, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Although it was open yesterday afternoon for a little while, between Columbus and Michigan, it was open. But you will see that start to close. It was closed this morning here for this event, and you will be by the end of by this time next week when we're here. That will probably all be cordoned off.
I'm sure.
Lollapalooza.
I'm sure. You sure it wasn't cordoned off for all of the angry Pokemon people?
Well, that was going on yesterday too.
What a fiasco!
That turned out to be something.
You know, I would normally say I don't mean to laugh, but I do mean to laugh. I mean, that whole phenomena just befuddles me completely. And
you know what? I have no idea what to do with that. I'm not even aware of how that works. Sorry, I'm in the dark here on this.
Well, I mean, it's like a virtual reality collection game where you find things and collect them and that kind of thing.
Okay.
And so that's what they were supposedly going to be having this big festival over in Grant Park.
Well, there were a lot of people down there yesterday. Turned out to be a lot of angry people down there yesterday.
Yeah. Well, I guess if you're going to have a kind of a computer-related virtual reality festival, you'd want to make sure that you tried out the computer servers first.
Mm-hmm.
Since apparently they didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And
or they might have gotten overwhelmed.
No, they just didn't
work. Oh, they didn't
work
in the first place.
Yeah. And people came from all over the place for this.
Yeah.
I was reading some of the reports, although I can't imagine why. But I'm sorry. I just don't get it. I mean, instead of playing virtual reality, you could have been out at Wrigley Field yesterday for what a ball game that was. I mean, just – I mean, Lester and versus Wainwright. I mean, you couldn't ask for a better matchup yesterday. And coming off that horrible series opener where the Cubs were winning 3-2 going into the top of the eighth and then give up 9 runs, yesterday watching this pitching duel was just fantastic.
And the eighth inning again, the crazy inning, right? The eighth inning.
Exactly.
Cardinals scored 2 in the eighth. Cubs come back and get 3 right away. I did like, too, of all the people to break up John Lester's perfect game,
yes.
It was Adam Wainwright, the pitcher, with a single in the sixth.
It's always that way, you know? It's always that way. And then the second hit Lester gives up is a home run. And the third hit he gives up is a home run.
He pitched so well, and then 2 pitches later, he's losing 2-0.
Right. And I have to say, you know, I was keeping up with the game a little bit on my phone until, because I had to work most of the day yesterday, but I did get to see on the final couple of innings, which of course included the crazy eight inning. And I thought, and I'm looking at Lester's pitch count was still like in the 80s or something, I think at that point, or nearing 90, but I'm going, wow, he must really have had a great game so far. 10 strikeouts, I think he had, no walks. But then as soon as he gave up that first home run, I thought, you know, I'd think about pulling him. Only just because of the karma factor. And then sure enough, the next hit's a home run too. But my gosh, the bottom of the eighth was, you couldn't ask for better baseball. And frankly, when you're playing the Cardinals, you got to love games like that.
How about Bryant? He was on first base. They put the hit and run in play. So he takes off on the pitch, and Rizzo pretty much just blooped one.
It was, right? It looked like it was right off his fists or something.
Shallow left center in front of all people, Dexter Fowler,
yes.
Who kind of hot doggily got to the ball and made a poor throw to the plate. But Bryant scored from first on a bloop hit into the outfield, which is amazing. He's such a good base runner.
Well, I mean, he was rolling. And I think it was 2 outs, wasn't it, at that point?
I believe so, yeah.
So, I mean, because you have to wonder – if it wasn't for the 2 outs, whether he would have scored or not.
Yeah, there were 2 outs. Zobrist doubled, Bryant singled, Rizzo doubled. So they did it all with 2.
Yeah, and that's when, I mean, that's the Cubs were used to. I mean, the scoring the runs with 2 outs.
Wait, what do you mean the Cubs were used to? The Cubs of last year or
last
the Cubs
year,
of all time?
Last year.
Okay, all right,
last
we had to
year.
Clear that up.
Yes, no, I'm speaking of the world champion,
okay,
Chicago
right.
Cubs, okay? It was their remarkable ability to score with 2 outs.
Yeah.
But I still think that the Cardinals catcher, I don't think it was necessarily a bad throw by Fowler. It could have been a better throw, but I think Molina didn't handle it properly, or it would have been a much closer play than him not just fumbling the ball. I think if he had got the ball, it would have been a really close play at home.
And how about Wade Davis, too? Does he make you nervous, even though he gets it done every time?
Oh, I know.
He's 19 for 19.
I know, but what scare. What a scare factor. And I noticed there was a walk to the mound while he was out there, and everybody was checking with Contreras to see, like, is Davis okay, you know, and Contreras nodded his head. So, but, yeah, fantastic game, and big game tonight, the national game on ESPN.
And Jose Quintana's Wrigley debut as a Cub.
Wow. I heard something about how he was driving, he drove to the ballpark, drove to Wrigley for the first time, and he got on Lakeshore Drive and got lost.
What?
Yeah.
He's been there before.
Well, I guess, but I never probably drove there before.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, they probably took a bus
right.
From the south side to the north side. Yeah, now he's got to figure out on his own. Or he needs your app.
That's right.
Get on that.
He probably ran into the orange cones.
We've got to come up with a name for this app now.
The Sunshine.
Sunshine Schwanny app.
There you
That's
go.
That's too much of a tongue twister, though. Say that real fast. Sunshine Schwanny.
I'll let you do it.
Now, with my luck, it'll come out.
don't okay, never mind. Never mind. We won't go there. That's okay. Yeah, but that
No, I will text you, Sam, to let you know what's going on here from now on.
You're a lifesaver.
I say that every Sunday morning about Mr. Schwann. He is a lifesaver. Absolutely. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Sam, of course, has all the sports. Producer Jasmine is here to field your phone calls. We're at 312-981-7200. That's also our text line, 312-981-7200. And we're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. On Twitter, @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is by my side sampling barbecue sauce recipes. Remember, you can always find our shows on WGNradio.com if you have to tune away. And you can also find our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. Up ahead, after Dave gives us the 7:30 news update, we'll speak with my Tribune colleague, Hal Dardick. It's been a busy week for Hal. We'll talk about the latest with the school funding issue, which involves not only schools in Chicago, but statewide. We'll also talk about the politics of property assessments. And then there are those weird emails from the city water department. Dave will be back with a news update at 8, and then we'll talk to Democratic State Representative Anna Moeller of Elgin. She's been named a member of a new task force on community care services, and she's been active on the issue as the Rauner administration looks at a program that could affect seniors who are currently getting in-home care. We'll have more news and sports at 8:30, and then we'll be joined by Kent Redfield. Kent's a good friend of mine. He's the political science professor emeritus at the University of Illinois at Springfield. He's also part of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. And he's a scholar on campaign finance, and we'll be talking about the big money race already for the race for governor at this early stage. That's all coming up, but first we're going to take a break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on a sunny, but a little humid North Michigan Avenue. Thanks for listening this morning. It's time for our weekly spin through national politics, and Congress has reached a deal on sweeping sanctions to punish Russia for its election meddling as well as aggression towards its neighbors. And this could create a very stark choice for the president, whether to veto the bill or sign it. One of the more interesting factors in this agreement is that the new legislation sharply limits the president's ability to suspend or terminate the sanctions. And of course, the issue of sanctions, the issue of Russia, that is the issue that has engulfed the Trump administration. We also had the stunning news on Friday that Sean Spicer had given up the job he'd always wanted, White House press secretary, after 6 months. He disagreed with President Trump's move to install hedge fund expert Anthony Scaramucci as chief of communications. Here's Scaramucci's debut speaking to the White House press corps at a briefing. And he's the chief of communications, and there were some communications problems.
First off, I'd like to announce formally that Sarah Huckabee Sanders is going to be the press. Oh, you can't hear me? I'm sorry. Better? Sarah Huckabee Sanders is going to be the press secretary. And so you can congratulate her after the session. You still can't hear me? No sound? Okay. Better? Better now? Better now? I'm going to start over. You guys heard me in the front, though, right? What did I say, John? Sarah's going to be the press secretary, right? Okay, so congratulations to you, sir.
So that's Anthony Scaramucci, the new communications director of the White House. Of course, another big news week in Washington. President Trump sat down with the New York Times, you know, the paper he calls the failing New York Times, but he sat down with them anyway, and he revealed that if he had known that Jeff Sessions was going to recuse himself from the Russia investigation, he never would have given him the attorney general's job. Here's the president speaking to the failing New York Times.
Sessions gets the job. Right after he gets the job, he recuses himself.
Was that a mistake?
Well, Sessions should have never recused himself. And if he was going to recuse himself, he should have told me before he took the job, and I would have picked somebody else.
Mm-hmm. He gave you no heads up at all.
Zero. Okay. So Jeff Sessions takes the job, gets into the job, recuses himself. I then have, which frankly, I think is very unfair to the president. How do you take a job and then recuse yourself? If he would have recused himself before the job, I would have said, thanks, Jeff, but I can't, you know, I'm not going to take you. It's extremely unfair, and that's a mild word, to the president.
So, of course, late Friday, we also learned from the Washington Post about detailed U.S. intercepts showing Sessions may have had more robust conversations with the Russians during Trump's campaign than he originally let on. Still, after Trump bashed Sessions, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and Acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe, well, they're all staying on. Here's Jeff Sessions.
The work we're doing today is the kind of work that we intend to continue. Just last week, we announced the largest health care takedown ever in the United States. We had all the major law enforcement leaders in my office yesterday to talk about our unified efforts to improve our crime fighting with state and local officials. So I'm totally confident that we can continue to run this office in an effective way.
Now, before she was elevated to Sean Spicer's job, Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked if the president still had confidence in Jeff Sessions after what the president had told the New York Times.
As the president said yesterday, he was disappointed in the Attorney General Sessions' decision to recuse himself, but clearly he has confidence in him or he would not be the Attorney General.
Sarah, can I follow up on that one? You said the president has confidence in the Attorney General. Does the president believe that the Attorney General serves the president or the Constitution?
I believe that the president, I think that's kind of a both. Obviously, the Attorney General's job is to follow and uphold the Constitution, but also every member of the cabinet and the administration serves at the pleasure of the president.
Would the president prefer the Attorney General resign?
I believe I've answered that question.
It's a little bit of a slightly different nuance, though. That's all I'm asking. You said he has confidence in him. Does that mean he does not want him to resign?
I think you know this president well enough to know that if he wanted somebody to take an action, he would make that quite clear.
He would make that quite clear. And, in fact, some have suggested that the Washington Post story about the U.S. intercepts involving Jeff Sessions and the Russians might have actually come from a certain office in the White House. But we don't know that for certain. We've also got plenty going on in Congress as Senate Republican leadership tries to rescue itself and force a vote on plans to repeal and replace Obamacare. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell plans for a vote on Tuesday, even though a procedural vote that's necessary might fail. You also have the fact that the Senate parliamentarian has ruled that certain provisions involving a repeal, certain provisions that Republicans want, like to eliminate funding for Planned Parenthood, would actually require a 60-vote action, not a 50-vote majority under reconciliation rules. So that even provides a larger hurdle, even though Republicans, they only have 52, they face a tremendous hurdle just to move procedurally to get to the point of considering any kind of repeal and replacement. Even so, you have the president saying that the Senate should stay in session through its August recess, if necessary, to get the job done.
For 7 years, you promised the American people that you would repeal Obamacare. People are hurting. Inaction is not an option. And frankly, I don't think we should leave town unless we have a health insurance plan, unless we can give our people great health care, because we're close. We're very close. The other night, I was very surprised when I heard a couple of my friends, they really were and are. They might not be very much longer, but that's okay.
So some certain warnings there from the president about certain reluctant Senate Republicans on the issue of health care. Illinois' senior senator, Democrat Dick Durbin, said he thought that the president, in suggesting that the government just let Obamacare fail in order to get Democrat support for a repeal and replacement, only hurts people in need of health care.
This is an irresponsible position to take. This isn't forfeiting a softball game. It isn't failing to eat your peas on your plate. It is saying to a lot of helpless and people who are in desperate need, you're on your own. We don't care if you have health insurance. We don't care if you get the health care that your family needs. No president should ever say that. The fact is, the president and the Republican Congress now have the responsibility for health care in America. They cannot find a way to repeal and replace what I suggest to them, something radical. Why don't we sit down together, Democrats and Republicans, work out the weaknesses and repair the things that need to be repaired in this system? But to walk away from it and say we're going to let it fail is to turn your back on your responsibility to the American people.
That's Illinois Democratic Senator Dick Durbin. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking to my Tribune colleague, Hal Dardick, from the Tribune's political team. All kinds of subjects to talk about. It was a busy last week for Hal. And, of course, this will just be the topping on the cake for him.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Here in the Allstate Showcase studio on North Michigan Avenue in historic Tribune Tower. Joining me on the phone is my Tribune colleague, Hal Dardick. And Hal, thank you so much for joining me after the quite busy week that you had last week.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Rick.
I appreciate you saying that. I'm sure you'll tell me the truth tomorrow. Well, let's kind of pick up where you picked up last week in the early part of the week. This whole issue of the kind of battle that's going on between Republican Governor Bruce Rauner and the Democratic-controlled legislature over the fate of general state aid school funding for the Chicago Public Schools and schools throughout the state. This all over an issue that the Democrat-led legislature has passed a bill but has not yet sent it to the governor, which would change the way that the general state aid money is doled out to school districts across the state. And yes, we do have a budget agreement, and we have a budget enacted, the override over the governor's veto. We finally have a budget. But in that budget was the proviso that this new, a new school aid formula had to be adopted in order to dole out the money. And the governor has said he's going to veto that. What's his explanation for that veto threat?
His explanation for that is that it would be, as he describes it, a bailout for Chicago Public Schools because it would provide them with additional money for pensions, $215 million, and also continue to provide them with a larger portion of grant money that goes to school districts than it would normally be entitled to if they did it strictly on a per-student basis. And so he's sort of set this line in the sand, I'm not going to bail out the Chicago Public Schools. Chicago Public Schools, of course, vehemently denies that it's a bailout. They claim that it's not even the amount of money that they would get out of that bill, which is around $300 million additional funding per year, is not even as much as they are entitled to. These are arguments that have been going on between Democrats and Republicans for many, many years now. And what we tried to do in the story is break down, look at the numbers, break down these arguments, and see who was telling the truth. As it happens, they were both telling the truth, but not the whole truth.
Wow, there's something new in politics, isn't it?
Yeah, right? I was just going to say, as is often the case in politics. So what happens is, because of the way they handed over the Chicago Public Schools to the mayor of the city back in 1995, when it was experiencing another financial catastrophe, one of many it's experienced over the decades, they gave Chicago Public Schools a fixed percentage of the grant money goes to special education, busing, you know, things that
they're known as categorical programs.
Correct. And so as the CPS student count declined relative to the rest of the state, the percentage that they got was made it get more money than it would have under the way they divvy up that money. So it gets about $250 million extra in those grants. And Rauner keeps pointing it out, and CPS does not disagree. So if you take just the education money and the grant money, CPS has 18.8% of the students, but it gets 23.6% of all the education funding in the state. So that's where the Republican argument holds water. But what the Republicans tend to ignore is in 1995, they also pledged to CPS that they would give them 20 to 30% of the amount of money they give each year for the teacher's retirement system pension. And that's all the pension systems for every other school district.
Outside Chicago.
Outside Chicago, right. K through high school.
Right.
And so if you take that, and that amount that they've been giving to Chicago Public Schools was like 23% that first year, 1995, and then it dropped below 20% every year after that. And in recent years, as the amount of money that they've been pouring into the teachers' retirement system has shot up exponentially because that was so poorly funded, and the state never funded that properly, the amount that they've given the Chicago Public Schools has dwindled to below $2 million from what was originally, you know, 61, I think, in 1995. So they're only getting less, or about a third of 1% of the pension money that the state spends every year. If you gave them all that, so if you add that in, CPS gets 15.3% of all money spent on education, including pensions, when it has 18.8% of the population. We ran the numbers. If they gave CPS the amount based on its population, it would get an extra $500 million a year. So that's where the CPS argument comes in. Okay, you're going to give us $300 million in this new bill. We're entitled to $500 million. That's Forrest Claypool's argument, the CEO of CPS. So what CPS doesn't tell you is that a lot of that problem is because they did not properly fund their pensions. And for 10 years, they skipped pension payments since 1995. Another 3 years, they skimped on pension payments. So they got themselves into a lot of this trouble, and they borrowed too much money. Rather than spending it directly on education. So they have a very high debt burden at the same time. Countering that, Claypool will tell you, well, look at TRS. They're worse funded in percentage terms than the Chicago Teachers Pension Fund, which is a separate pension fund from the rest of the state. So, you know, he says, so why punish us because we didn't do the right thing when the state didn't do the right thing either? So, those are the numbers broken down, but people are, as you know, so hardened in their rhetoric that, especially the governor at this point, that it's hard to know how this will turn out.
Well, and what we have seen, and a couple of things to note, too, in 1995, that actually was a time when Republicans controlled the General Assembly.
Right, and they had refused to loan more money to CPS because of its financial condition, things that would sound familiar to us today, junk bond status, not enough cash to, you know, keep operating on a daily basis. And so, and the state actually had a special authority that sort of oversaw finances, but yet they were about to throw up their hands. And so what they did, Richard M. Daley asked for control, and so the Republicans sort of said, fine, you want control of it? Here you go.
And and Republicans approved it, and Governor Edgar signed the legislation.
Right.
And as frankly, the Republican attitude then was, okay, you want it, fine, be careful what you wish for. And,
right. And back in those days, I covered DuPage County for other publications, and I occasionally talked to James Page Phillip, the Republican Senate president back then, and I remember him saying, you know, great. Let's give it to Daley. Let it be his problem.
Absolutely. And at that time, too, the Chicago teachers pension system, funded by property taxes, local property taxes, and that leads to that argument, that every other school district's pensions are covered by the state except Chicago's.
Right.
But at that time, the Chicago Teachers Pension Fund was, I believe, 90% funded.
It actually, if you look at the numbers, was more than 100% funded. Can you imagine?
Huh.
and it stayed more than 100% funded for 5 years after skipping payments after 1990. They were so well funded. But what they did that changed that dramatically was for 10 years they skipped pension payments and diverted all the money that they had been collecting for pensions to educational costs. Because they were trying to, shore that up. And for a while, that was okay, but the returns on their investments weren't as good, and it started to decline. And they had two downturns, and now they're about 50% funded. They also, interestingly enough, removed a special property tax that was levied just for the pension fund, and they took the money that they were getting from that and poured that into education. If they had kept that, they'd probably be in much, much sounder shape. And what's really interesting about that is that under Mayor Rahm Emanuel, in the last year, they restored that property tax, which is one reason why in Chicago property tax bills are going up significantly again this year.
So statewide, we have the issue of the governor issuing this veto threat, basically saying that he would use an amendatory veto to remove the Chicago pension language from this legislation. And it really boils down to the fact that you have this bill that has passed. Democrats are holding on to the bill. And, of course, as we get closer to August, schools around the state looking for what are we going to have for state funding? Because for the most part, that's been something that has moved along despite the budget impasse, even though schools are still owed in back payment over $1 billion because of the budget impasse. But you have the governor saying he would use his amendatory veto, basically coming down to the fact that Mike Madigan, the House Speaker, does not really recognize the authority of the governor to use a mandatory veto. So it's either it would be dead and there would be no school funding on the table, or they try to override this. And the governor has issued a Monday deadline for the legislature to turn over Senate Bill 1, as it's known. And the bill has immense support from school administrators throughout the state. And the bottom line, as Democrats will argue, is it's all a definition of a clause called hold harmless, that every school district in the state would get at least what it has gotten before. And so that's why you have these various things built into the bill, what's deemed as a hold harmless. And there's a Republican version of this legislation that strips out that Chicago money. And also would gradually change the way funds are allocated to a per-pupil basis. But throughout the state, a number of superintendents overwhelmingly supporting the bill as passed by the legislature. So we'll see how this all shapes up as we get closer to the opening of schools starting next month. We're speaking with Hal Dardick. He's my Tribune colleague over on the political team. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, and joining me on the phone is my Tribune colleague, Hal Dardick, from the political team. And now that we've talked about the school opus, and we'll be talking about that later in the show as well. But I also wanted to talk to you about kind of this issue of Joe Berrios, the issue of property assessments. The Tribune, of course, had a huge story, you know, questioning the system of assessments, the way properties were being assessed in Cook County. Where do things stand? I mean, it seemed like Berrios was called on the carpet by the county board members the other day.
Yeah, they called him in a fairly, well, maybe unprecedented, I don't know, going back in all of history, but a very unusual move. They called Joe Berrios, who's also, you know, as you say, the chairman of the Cook County Democratic Party, before the county board and said, explain how you do your job and why you're not basically shafting poor people in the process of assessing properties, which determines how much people pay in property taxes. So it was quite an interesting turn of events for a guy that was raised in Cabrini Green and was one of the first Latino politicians in the state to rise to high levels. But what they're concerned about is the Tribune did a very thorough analysis and determined that the way the properties are assessed, they're assessing higher value properties at too low of a rate generally, and lower value properties at too high of a rate, which means that people in poor communities, and mostly communities where African Americans and Latinos live, are probably paying more than their fair share. And Berrios had a formula that a number of people in the McCormick Foundation I don't know if it was the McCormick Foundation, but I'm trying to think, MacArthur Foundation helped fund, that would have fixed the system, they say, and he never fully implemented it. So he was called before the county board. Cook County Commissioner Jesus Chuy Garcia was particularly strong in his questioning of Berrios and why the system works. And so while other commissioners, I think in part because of Joe's political power, were a little more deferential to Assessor Berrios than you might expect in such a situation, and they wanted to know what he's going to do about it. And basically what they said, and Tony Preckwinkle, the county board president, who's his strong ally, announced that they would be doing a study of this. Well, the folks that are critical said, well, we've already done four or five studies. We know what needs to be done. Why are you doing another study? And President Preckwinkle announced that at the end of the hearing. Her aides came out and handed out the press releases to the media right as the hearing was ending, which meant, and also the commissioners didn't know exactly what she was doing, and it was kind of a weak press release, and it said, okay, we're engaging this not-for-profit group to tell us what the scope of the study will be and who we need to hire. It wasn't even a study.
It was about the people to how do you do a study.
Right. So it raised eyebrows. Was Tony Preckwinkle trying to divert attention from the problems in the system and her ally, Joe Berrios, being called on the carpet? Now, I asked President Preckwinkle about that a day later when I got a chance, and she said, well, that was when it came together, and we've been working on this for a while, and with the Civic Consulting Alliance, and that was just the way the timing happened. Well, you know, right at the end of the hearing, it raises questions. Let's put it that way.
It's curious. It's curious.
Yeah, yes, it is. So, your, I think, initial question was, well, what happens then? Well, I don't know. They'll do another study. We don't know how long that will take. We don't know what will come of it. And the critics, who are really well versed in the system, seem to think, well, you know, you can go in there, you can use this formula that was already devised and that the Tribune pointed out was never fully implemented, and you can fix it with that system. It addresses the problems and go from there. If it needs tweaking, whatever, but, you know, you have the answer, so what are you doing? There's a lot of politics tied up in this with Joe Barris being the chairman and ally of House Speaker Mike Madigan, and Madigan having a practice in real estate that specializes in helping people appeal their property tax assessments. And the lawyers that do this work contribute a lot of money to Joe Barrios. Some of the commissioners are trying to put a stop to allowing those contributions, but I don't see them having the votes to move that forward. But just a lot of influential Democrats who have, in some sense, their livelihoods tied up in this system. And what the Tribune also found was that the Barrios likes to point out, well, you know, we've got record numbers of appeals. We're helping people. What it found was that the more affluent people have more of the wherewithal to do appeals, whether they can hire attorneys or they have the time, you know, because they're not working all the time or whatever. And after appeals, the system is more unfair than it was before appeals.
And all of this playing out against the backdrop of the 2018 elections, and the
right.
Cook County Democratic Organization, headed by Joe Barrios, still deciding on slating of its candidates. So all things to keep an eye on. And helping to keep an eye on that is Hal Dardick from our Tribune political team. Hal, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Rick. Appreciate it.
We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking to Democratic State Representative Anna Moeller from Elgin.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, and welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase studio on North Michigan Avenue. Still a bit humid out there, so just watch things, and as Dave mentioned, chance for scattered showers, moderate risk of severe storms, so keep an eye on that this afternoon. Earlier in the show, I mentioned the fact that the news on Friday that after 6 months on the job that Sean Spicer had given up his position as White House press secretary. And The Daily Show on Comedy Central put together a compilation of Sean Spicer's greatest hits to mark his departure from the White House press room podium. So here is their send-off on Spicer's send-off.
Guys, good morning. Good afternoon.
Good evening. Good afternoon.
This was the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period.
You're shaking your head. I appreciate it, but with respect to hold on 1 second. You don't get to just yell out questions. We're going to raise our hand like big boys and girls. Denmark as a education point. Points.
Bashar al-Assad.
Bashar al-Assad. I know you've mispronounced his name a few times.
Hitler, who didn't even sink to using chemical weapons.
As many of you know.
Okay, Jonathan, somebody's asking a question. It's not your press briefing. Major, you want to come on up? And with that, I'm glad to take some questions. Steve Holland.
Steve Holland's not here.
With that, David Jackson.
David is not here.
Eamon Javers. I will let the tweet speak for itself. Yeah, I'm going to let the tweet speak for itself. His tweets speak for themselves. His tweets do speak for themselves. I mean, that's the silliest thing I've ever heard. Okay, this is silly. Okay, next. Stop shaking your head again.
And see, that's how you ought to leave. Leave them wanting more. That's Comedy Central's mashup of Sean Spicer's greatest hits. Well, joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Democratic State Representative Anna Moeller from Elgin. And the representative was recently named a member of the new Community Care Program Services Task Force, which was part of the recent budget enactment. I won't say budget deal, but budget enactment. How about that? Representative, thank you so much for joining me here this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
I know this is an issue, the community care program is an issue you have been just overwhelmingly involved in. And part of it is because the governor had proposed a massive revamp of this program. And maybe you can explain what he was looking at and what we have the budget right now and what it does.
Sure. So our existing program that's been in place for about 30 years is the community care program, and it provides services to seniors who would otherwise be eligible to go into a nursing home. So we're talking about frail elderly who need help with daily activities, going to the doctor, making sure they're taking their medications, that they're eating right, that they're bathing, general health and welfare of our seniors who are living in their homes. The Department of Aging and the Governor's Office last year proposed changing that program to the Community Reinvestment Program. They're characterizing it as providing more flexible services to seniors. Instead of providing a daily home care, making modifications to a senior's home or providing apps on their phone so that they can access transportation services.
I'm sorry, I snickered there. You couldn't, and this is no offense to the elderly, but this is not exactly a tech-savvy population.
Right. These are people who, if they were not receiving these services, would need to have 24-hour care in a nursing home. And so, yes, we were concerned with the proposed changes and the consequences that could come from these new flexible services, quote unquote, that the department was advocating for, in that it would result in seniors having to end up going into a more intensive nursing care facility.
And more costly. I mean, that's the whole aim of the community care program, is that this is a less expensive alternative to nursing homes.
Absolutely. Exponentially. We spend about $8,000 a year on seniors through the community care program. A full-time nursing facility, it's upwards of $30,000 a year. So we are saving money for taxpayers in the state and providing a higher quality of life. Most people want to stay in their homes if they're able to, with some assistance. We felt it going through. We had a number of hearings in the House Aging Committee, listening to AARP, the community care providers, people who work with seniors on a daily basis. And by and large, all of these organizations and groups were opposed to the changes that the department was proposing because of concerns that seniors would end up losing care and ending up, becoming dependent on nursing facilities. It also became clear that the driver of this change was to cut $120 million initially out of the program. And while we're always looking for ways to save money and become more cost effective, we felt that putting that priority over the care of seniors, the care that is saving the state money long term, would be very short-sighted and end up affecting the quality of life of, we're talking about 40,000 seniors in the state, who could be potentially affected by these changes. So we have taken a very close look at what the department is proposing. Another concern is that these changes are being proposed to go through an administrative rules process versus the entire General Assembly weighing in on such a dramatic change to a fundamental program here in Illinois. And as a result of the budget deal that was passed a couple weeks ago, a community care program task force was created in an attempt to show a good faith effort to look at the existing program and find ways to save and money and to make this program more efficient and more effective by bringing in the different stakeholder groups that provide care to seniors. Every program, can withstand some scrutiny and can be improved. But we feel that anything that such sweeping changes really need to be made with the full input of all of the organizations that are providing care to seniors, with senior input, and with input from the General Assembly before any changes are made.
We're speaking with Democratic State Representative Anna Moeller from Elgin. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. Joining me here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Democratic State Representative Anna Moeller from Elgin. We're talking about the governor and his proposed changes to the community care program, which provides in-home services to elderly that require these services. The governor wants to change that into what he calls a community reinvestment program, claims that there would be $120 million in savings as a result of this, but obviously there's concerns by all kinds of groups about what those changes might mean. Mm-hmm. Before the break, we were talking about the fact that he proposed doing this through what's known as the rulemaking process rather than through a legislative change. The budget, as enacted, continues to fund the current program. We have this task force to look at cost savings that where it can be done. Right. But the fact is, those rules that he has proposed to enact this other program mm-hmm. are still going through process and could be voted upon.
Right. That is our understanding, that they are moving forward with the rules process.
What does that mean? I mean, we know what's funded right. is the current program.
Right.
If they change the rules.
If they change the rules, then there is no funding for the new program, the community reinvestment program. And so there is a little bit of uncertainty if JCAR were to enact these rules.
The Joint Committee on Administrative Rules.
Exactly. What the ending result would be, if it would automatically revert back to the CCP program, which is funded in the budget, or if there would be some type of legislation that would be required, or reversal of the JCAR rules that would be required if the CRP were approved through JCAR.
I mean, is it possible that if the rules are enacted and there's no funding for the program under that, but we have an existing program that is being funded, but if the rules get enacted, that supersedes, and then there is no funding for anybody, for those seniors?
Yeah, and I think all members of JCAR should be cognizant of the fact that we have funding in the budget for the existing program. Let's work through this task force that's been created. It's a bicameral, bipartisan task force.
Representatives from the governor.
Representatives from the governor's office. Representatives from all of the different stakeholder groups who serve seniors on a daily basis. Let's work through that process so that we can find savings and improvements to the current program.
And that's not to say that the task force won't look at some of these
absolutely.
Issues that were being looked at under the governor's program as
absolutely,
well.
Absolutely, absolutely. But this will be a more open, transparent, and inclusive process, and in an expedited process. The task force is assigned with coming up with recommendations by the end of January. So it's not something that we can sit on for a year before we come out with our proposals for the current program. So I think that would be a better process, and I would hope that the governor and the Department of Aging would recognize the realities of the fact that we have funding in this budget for the current program, put seniors' minds at ease that their current services that they're provided right now will not change. That's been part of the consternation over the past year, as a lot of seniors, a lot of organizations that provide care are not sure how long these services will last because of the department's proposed changes. And this is a vulnerable population, and they need some assurance that the care that they're getting, the care providers who are providing the services to them, who come into their homes, that they people they trust and who have provided their services are going to be there for them. I think it would serve all parties well to have that assurance that we're going to continue what we're doing right now and look at ways to make it better for the future.
I think I would ask you to sponsor a resolution to change the state slogan from Land of Lincoln to Illinois, a state of uncertainty. And speaking of uncertainty, I'm going to shift to
sure.
another topic
mm-hmm.
here.
Yes.
Senate Bill 1. That's
right.
The education state aid formula funding bill. I spoke last hour with Hal Dardick from the Tribune's political team.
Yeah.
As he and my colleague Kim Geiger took a look last week at the various claims on both sides. We have the governor out there saying, you know, it's a Chicago bailout for Chicago public schools, that he would veto that language out. He hasn't gotten the bill yet. He set a deadline of Monday, or he would call the legislature into special session.
Right.
Questions about what that really would accomplish.
Yeah.
But you have the governor traveling largely through downstate communities, raising this as a bailout for Chicago public schools. Yet, just and I'll admit this is anecdotal, but in looking on social media, on my Twitter feed, you have the governor claiming that all of these school superintendents throughout the state, Mike Madigan's put a gun to their head, and that's why they're saying they support this legislation that's passed. But you've got the superintendent saying, "I've never talked to Mike Madigan. I just, you know, this is a bill that is passed the legislature."
Yeah, yeah.
And most schools get more money out of this.
Right. Every school is at least held harmless under Senate Bill 1. Most school districts get additional funding. I know U46, the second largest school district in the state and the largest school district in my district, supports Senate Bill 1. They would receive additional funding under the bill, which is a good thing. We have a high poverty population in U46, and we have a lot of students with special needs. This new formula would address that and provide greater equity for school districts that have students who need additional help. All of the superintendents I've talked to support Senate Bill 1. They recognize this is the bill that passed both chambers. It was negotiated with Republicans and Democrats. And this is the most realistic path forward right now. The governor has said he agrees with 90% of the bill. And yet he still plans to veto it. And, you know, it's disconcerting that when you get 90% of something, you're still going to oppose it. That's not how compromise works.
Well, and when you're looking, you know, with his desire for a property tax freeze, we know how everybody hates property taxes.
Sure.
But also that's the primary method of funding public schools in this state. And until we radically change our tax system in this state, if we ever do, that's the way it's going
right.
to be. But now you have a formula that, now they argue that, well, the money that would be for Chicago, the quote bailout money, that would be rolled into their formula, the Republican alternative formula, and that would mean even more money for schools, and that this is Chicago taking away from other school districts.
We haven't seen that new formula. The governor has not unveiled that new formula. So it's hard to analyze against what we currently know in Senate Bill 1. Over 200 school districts get more funding per pupil in Senate Bill 1 than the city of Chicago. All school districts benefit under this. We can't continue, and because prior school funding formula bills have failed is because we're pitting one school district against another.
Right. It was always the list was, let's see the winners and let's see the losers. And traditionally, the losers were suburban school districts.
Right. And that's not the case under Senate Bill 1. Suburban school districts support Senate Bill 1, even with the funding for Chicago public schools. They recognize that all school districts need to benefit under whatever formula we're going to enact. And this is the best formula, the best bill that we've seen come out of that work in many years. And for a governor to claim that he agrees with 90% of the bill and yet still plans to veto it with schools set to open here in a month is very troubling. And I don't know what a special session would do. Special sessions are very expensive. I would hope that any concerns that he has with the existing bill, he would sit down with leadership in the House and the Senate to work that out instead of calling a special session, dubious results coming from that.
Knowing that the Speaker does not really consider amendatory vetoes, and that's been true regardless of party. That's just the way. So that means you either would have to vote to accept whatever changes the governor makes, And that's something people have been asking is what's the language that you're going to want to change here? Or overriding that veto.
Right.
Do you think there are the votes in the House to override?
Well, I think there's a question as to the legality of an amendatory veto on Senate Bill 1. So that's been called into question if he can even if his only option is to a total veto or signing it. There's still questions as to whether he can amendatorily veto it because it's not an appropriations bill. I don't know if there would be the votes for if he's going to be carving out Chicago, the funding for Chicago. I don't imagine there are going to be a lot of Chicago legislators who are going to be able to support a bill that takes money away from their students.
I mean, I just wonder if it gets to the point that if it's, you know, this is about the public funding of public schools, that as we saw with some Republicans crossing over to enact a budget, the pressures that legislators individually may face in their districts, were they to allow schools not to open because of a lack of money.
Well, and that just speaks to this entire, what we've experienced over the last couple of years. It should never come down to this crisis situation on every issue. There should be the ability to sit down and talk and compromise and work out an agreement. To hold things up, to wait until the last minute, to continue to demand 100% on all issues before you will agree to sign off on a budget, to sign off on school funding, is just the wrong way to govern. As you said, we're in the state of uncertainty because of this approach. I would hope for a more rational style of governance where we can sit down and talk about our differences and not wait until the last minute and force a crisis so that the entire state is being held hostage to a political agenda that, quite frankly, keeps changing.
Remember what I said, Illinois, a state of uncertainty. Make a great bumper sticker, wouldn't it? That's Democratic State Representative Anna Mueller from Elgin. Thank you so much for joining me this
Thank
morning.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with Kent Redfield, Professor Emeritus at the University of Illinois at Springfield, member of the Institute of the Government and Public Affairs of the University of Illinois. We'll be talking about the money race for governor.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
312-981-7200 is our phone number. I'm Rick Pearson. This is your Sunday Spin. Joining me now on the phone is Kent Redfield. He's Professor Emeritus at the University of Illinois at Springfield and a member of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. And frankly, no one knows more about political campaign finance than Kent Redfield. Kent, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Good to be here.
Well, we've obviously knew that this was going to be an expensive governor's race. We obviously know of Bruce Rauner's personal wealth and that he's not shy about using it for political campaigns, be it his own, the state Republican Party, or Republican candidates for the legislature. And of course, we also have in the Democratic primary, billionaire entrepreneur, an investor, J.B. Pritzker, an heir of the Hyatt Hotel fortune. But so we look at part of the reason I have Ken on is we've just seen the campaign finance reports filed for the second quarter of this year, the 3 months from April to June. And in that time period, those 3 months, and you've got, you know, a myriad candidates running for governor on the Democratic side, $36 million, more than $36 million was raised. 34 of it from two people. $20 million from Ken Griffin, the billionaire hedge fund founder who's an ally of Bruce Rauner, and $14 million from J.B. Pritzker, who is self-financing his own campaign. I guess we shouldn't be startled by big numbers anymore.
Well, no, I mean, these are staggering figures, and up until 2013, this would have just been unbelievable. I mean, we've never had anybody self-finance at more than you know, maybe $10 million, and then a losing candidate at that. And now, you know, we've seen $100 million governor's race. We've seen Bruce Rauner and Ken Griffin, and you have to add Richard Yulin into that. The three of them, you know, $100 million in the previous two cycles, and they're, you know, we've already got $50 million of Rauner's money and $20 million worth of Griffin's money in this cycle. And so it just, it's the new normal, but it's amazing how long, you know, it's just been a very short period of time when somebody putting $1 million into a campaign was huge news, and that certainly is not the case.
Now, I mean, there's always been the ability to self-fund as a candidate, but the fact that, you know, the big money also tied into the fact of the changing nature of campaign finance laws, I mean, that allow these kind of unlimited donations.
Yeah, you see a lot of, I mean, the big money in terms of individuals has always been there. I mean, and if someone wants to self-fund their campaign, they've always been able to do that. But now we've seen the ability to move a lot more money into independent expenditures. And so when we talk about, you know, the last two cycles, you know, you just look at the candidates' totals, that misses in the governor's race about $16 million worth of independent expenditures that big labor made against Bruce Rauner. When you get into the last cycle, on top of the $50 million that went through the political funds on the Republican side in the legislature, there's another $10 million in independent expenditures, primarily from Liberty Principles PAC. And so, while we got contribution limits in 2010, the changes in the court rulings in terms of independent expenditures and the fact that you can't limit self-funding, contribution limits in terms of statewide office are pretty irrelevant, and they really are not much of an obstacle in terms of getting big money into an individual legislative race. And so while there certainly was hope, the people that pushed campaign finance reform, and I was one of them, before 2010, it turned out that the victory won in terms of getting contribution limits has turned out to be pretty meaningless in terms of any kind of constraint on the money that's being put into politics in this state.
Although one aspect of that was the better reporting of these donations, so that,
no question,
which is helpful to be able to track everything that's going on. I mean, when you talk about this money, for example, the governor's campaign spent about $3.4 million in that April to June period, and about half of that went to the state Republican Party. But of course, we also had seen these ads featuring the governor. But those ads that ran for the most part during that period, that wasn't even paid for out of the governor's campaign fund. That was from an offshoot of the Republican Governors Association, and it was one of those tax-exempt offshoots that we don't know who the source of the money is, even though Rauner's campaign says that they weren't the source of the money, but we don't know where the money came from.
No. If they're depending on if it's a 527, which is one kind of federal classification, or if it's a 501c4, you may find out in a general sense who the donors were way after the fact, but most of the time there's no transparency at all in terms of the sources of money, and so those ubiquitous kind of duct tape ads were paid by one group that set up another group that was actually running the ads. And so you get a handle of what's going on, certainly, and some of that is timely. And Illinois' system is very good. You get real-time disclosure of a contribution over $1,000 or an independent expenditure over $1,000, all year round, and then, in a very short turnaround, right before an election. So, the information is out there much in a much better way than it is in lots of states. But It certainly is a new ball game. I mean, we had the most expensive legislative election in history 2 years ago in terms of, you know, $4 and $5 million races, and that's really what we're looking at this time around. And I'm sure is a concern of the Democrats is, you know, that if you have to, combat Rauner, Griffin / Euland's money in both the governor's race and the legislative races, you know, that you could get spread pretty thin if you're talking, $100 million kind of figures in terms of, the effort that it might take to cover both of those bases from a big, the big interest groups. That's what makes J.B. Pritzker attractive is, if he can self-fund the governor's race, then big labor, big law, health facility groups, nursing homes, hospitals, they tend to be donating to the Democratic candidates in the legislature. They would like to, to be able to focus on that and not have to put big money in the governor's race. We're a long way from there, but you can certainly understand, how Pritzker's campaign, just on its face, would look attractive to the Democrats and to their primary funders.
We're speaking to Kent Redfield from the University of Illinois at Springfield. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, and I'm speaking with Kent Redfield, Professor Emeritus from the University of Illinois at Springfield. We're talking about the early money race for governor. And Kent, before the break, we were talking about what makes J.B. Pritzker as an attractive Democratic candidate for some elements of the Democratic Party who want someone that can go toe-to-toe with the Rauner money on the Republican side, freeing up money for the legislative races. We look at what Pritzker spent in that April through June period, and you've got him spending like $9.3 million, I believe it was. And obviously we can see where that money was spent because all you have to do is turn on the TV.
Yeah, no, and if you are an unknown, which he is, you have to build your name recognition. He also wanted to position himself as someone who was, countering Rauner's message. And so, I mean, he was both trying to build name recognition, and he was also kind of auditioning with, the powers and the interest groups within the Democratic Party, saying, I can be out there and be taking on the governor directly, which is something that a lot of people were saying, where's the Democratic voices in terms of Rauner's commercials. $9 million is an incredible burn rate in terms of going.
Oh yeah, I mean $3 million a month. I guess when you have an unlimited checkbook, that's you're able to do those kinds of things.
Certainly. It is not inconceivable that we would challenge, the all-time record for kind of a governor's race seems to be about $250 million back in, I think, 2010 with
it was Meg Whitman in California, I believe.
And Jerry Brown. And you could certainly see those kinds of numbers in terms of this race. I mean, at some point, the eighth mailer you get or the fourth commercial you're watching in a row, it tends to, you're getting kind of marginal returns on that. But
do you think that's happened already, Kent? In some respects, I mean, it part of it is, we have people, obviously, it's July and we're talking about a primary in March. We're talking about a general election over a year away, but we have been inundated with TV ads from both Rauner and from Pritzker. Pritzker team has done mailings, Rauner's team has done mailings on legislative candidates already.
Yeah, it's just, you know, what we used to think about, what was the election cycle and when did things happen? I mean, that's just, it's become, you know, perpetual campaign, not only in raising money, but now in spending money. And I suspect it will, you know, we will get a hiatus now during the summer a little bit, but we're going to pick it back up in the fall. And plus certainly with Rauner's new communications team, and you know he's going to be out there, in his words, messaging in terms of his agenda items constantly. In terms of their conclusion was they didn't win because of the message, but because they didn't say it clearly enough and loudly enough. And so that background's going to be there. Eventually, the other candidates, and we certainly shouldn't, we need to talk about Kennedy and Biss, who have raised, Biss has impressive numbers if we were, talking, previous campaigns.
Normal times.
Yeah. Kennedy's name is out there, and so, he still has to make good on that. But, the biggest spender back in 2006 was Rod Gidwich, who ended up running, I think, fourth or fifth to Judy Barr Topinka. And so, spending money is one thing. You have to spend it effectively. People have to decide there's a there. And so there's a lot of campaign to go through between, now and next March.
You touched on the governor's change in staffing and communications team now kind of tapping into the Illinois Policy Institute. We have a story on the front page of the Sunday Tribune today with my colleagues Kim Geiger and Monique Garcia about messaging. I just found it kind of ironic when you look at the shakeup in the White House and the communications team there and Sean Spicer leaving, Anthony Scaramucci coming in as communications director, and Sarah taking over as the press secretary. And it's the same kind of argument, I think, that you're seeing with the governor from Trump, is that it's not that the message is wrong in their belief, it's that the message isn't being delivered properly.
And this is, Trump kind of wanted to, I think he redefined kind of what a campaign means in terms of, and Rauner to a certain extent also with the, shake up Springfield. And that seemed to be, an effective strategy in terms of getting elected. Now we've had, 2.5 years of Rauner, only 6 months of Trump, where, now we're kind of shifting, we'll shift to governing mode. And that requires people to work in kind of this, the old framework. And now you seem to see Rauner and Trump both saying, maybe that's not the way to go. Maybe we can take the way we ran campaigns and translate that into governing. Now, obviously a lot of people experienced in the legislature, experienced in Congress, think you can't do that, but that it certainly seems to be, quite similar in terms of kind of the conclusions that have been drawn and the directions things are going, not just in Washington, D.C., but also in Springfield.
That's Kent Redfield, Professor Emeritus from the University of Illinois at Springfield, a member of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. Kent, thanks so much, as always, for joining me.
Oh, certainly. Good to talk to you.
We'll be back with more right after this. Well, that's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guests, Hal Dardick, State Representative Anna Moeller, and Kent Redfield from the University of Illinois at Springfield. Most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening. And now it's time to turn things over to Brian Noonan in for Dean Richards.
Yes, Dean is in some undisclosed location.
I figure he's auditioning for Sean Spicer's job.
Could be.
He
would do a lot better.
I think, he would do great on that traveling motorized podium.
Yes, he's got the balance. He knows his way around New York. He could come here with the podium. He could go on a national tour. It would be terrific.
Maybe we should think of that. We should kind of do a GoFundMe starter for a Dean Richards presidential podium.
That sounds good. We're going to talk to Dean right after the top of the show. I'll bring that up.
Will you bring that?
I will broach the subject.
Well, if
no, I'll give you all the credit or the blame, however you want to look at it.
You don't want to wear the jacket for that one, okay?
I've heard somebody say we're not going to own that. I don't know. I don't remember who said we're not going to own it. Someone said it. We'll see. But it's always good to see you.
Always good to see you, my friend.